Imagine, if you will, just a world completely before contracts.
Right.
A world before property titles, before, courthouses with those grand marble columns, before limited liability corporations, and long before the invention of money.
A very hard thing for us to picture today.
It really is. But I want you, the listener, to really put yourself there. If you strip away every single statute, every treaty, every zoning ordinance and border checkpoint, what is actually left governing us?
Yeah.
Because if you asked a human being, like 50,000 years ago, what the law was, they wouldn't point to a piece of parchment.
No, they'd probably look at you like you were crazy.
Exactly. The answer, at its absolute unavoidable core, is life itself.
Right.
It's the ecosystems we inhabit. It's the shared community of the people standing right next to us. It's that visceral biological need for water, for food, for shelter, and honestly, for each other.
Yes.
Law, as we understand it today,
Yeah.
the paperwork, the fines, the judges, all of that came long, long after life.
It is a profound starting point, and I think it completely shifts how we view the rules that supposedly, govern our reality.
Yeah.
We are just so accustomed to the paperwork that we completely forget it is entirely invented.
Made up out of thin air.
Right. The living foundation, what academics might call organism niche relations or biospheric integrity, or simply just the ways communities care for one another, all of that precedes the legal and economic abstractions that we now treat as basically natural laws of the
You
universe.
treat them like gravity.
Exactly like gravity. And legal legitimacy, if we strip away all the historical baggage, it should depend entirely on whether those later forms of coordination actually remain in service to that original biological life.
And it is so strange when you really just sit with it. I mean, we live in a society where you need a piece of paper stamped by a total stranger in some distant building to prove that you have the right to stand on a specific patch of the earth.
Or to drink water.
Yeah, to prove you have the right to drink water from a river. And we just accept it. We don't even question it. But today, we're going to challenge that acceptance. Our mission for this deep dive is to unpack a truly fascinating, honestly paradigm-shifting academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Saheli. It's titled Life Coherent Jurisprudence.
It's a brilliant piece of work.
It really is. And we are going to explore how our legal systems accidentally drifted from protecting living, breathing humans to protecting abstract money and property. And most importantly, and I want to stress this, we are going to look at how we can fix this drift without just pointing fingers or assigning personal guilt or starting some endless blame war.
Which is such an essential caveat. I mean, this isn't about assigning villainy.
Right.
It's about diagnosing a systemic illness.
Yeah.
And what makes this paper so compelling is that it isn't just some abstract, philosophical exercise confined to a university library somewhere.
No, and it's close to home.
It really
Oh,
does.
yeah.
It touches on something almost everyone listening to us right now has experienced firsthand, often in very, very frustrating ways.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about it. Have you ever felt like a bureaucracy treats you more like a number or like a cost center than an actual human being?
Right.
Listeners, think about a time you've had to interact with a massive institution.
We've all been there.
Right. Have you ever had to prove your humanity, your basic need to exist, to a form that only understands data fields?
Check boxes.
Check boxes, exactly. Well, today we are going to explain exactly why that happens. We are going to reveal the hidden emotional architecture that is quite literally built into the laws that govern your everyday life.
I love that phrase, emotional architecture.
It's so fitting. But to really understand how the law treats us today, we kind of have to travel back and look at the original blueprint of human coordination. We have to look at how that blueprint got basically flipped upside down.
Flipped completely on its head.
Yeah. So Dr. Saheli refers to this original blueprint as life sequencing. Let's unpack this. Life sequencing. The idea here is that human survival originally followed a very specific, unbreakable logical order.
Right. And the sequence begins with a very simple, undeniable concept, which is need.
Mead.
Yes. Living beings are not abstractions. We are not equations on a talk board. We are flesh and blood, and we require calories, hydration, shelter, care, and a stable ecological fit.
You can't negotiate with a biological need.
You really can't. You can't tell your stomach to just wait until the next fiscal quarter.
Right.
So, because of that absolute necessity, we immediately enter into the second stage of the sequence, which is relation.
Relation, okay? Because a single human baby, or even a single adult, cannot fulfill its own needs entirely in a vacuum. We're inherently social creatures.
Exactly the mechanism. We exist in families, in clans, in communities, and within broader ecosystems. We relate to the soil that grows our food and the people who harvest it.
We're connected.
Right. And that living relation inevitably creates the third step, which is obligation.
Obligation. So we have need, relation, and now obligation.
Yes. Because when survival is shared, we naturally owe things to one another. I protect you while you sleep, you forage while I build the fire. It's reciprocal.
And that obligation naturally leads to the fourth step, right?
Yes. Restraint.
Restraint is such an interesting one to me, because if I'm thinking about early human tribes, restraint means I can't just, I don't know, take all the mammoth meat for myself.
Right, because what happens if you do?
If I do, the rest of the tribe starves, and then I have literally no one to help me hunt the next mammoth. I'd die anyway. I have to regulate my own desires for the common good.
That is the perfect illustration. We restrain hoarding, we restrain unchecked violence, we restrain the overharvesting of the forest. And because we practice restraint, we make the fifth step possible, which is sharing.
Sharing the mammoth.
Sharing the mammoth. The necessities of life are distributed so that the whole web of relations remains intact. But of course, you know, humans are fallible.
Things go wrong.
Things go very wrong. Harm still happens. Someone takes too much, or someone gets injured in a dispute, which necessitates the sixth step, which is repair. How do we heal the breach in the community?
And it's not about punishing someone just for the sake of causing them pain, right? It's about fixing the broken relationship so the group can survive.
Yes, exactly. The focus of repair in a life sequence is restoration, not retribution. You want them back in the hunting party, functioning.
Right.
And finally, all of these steps, need, relation, obligation, restraint, sharing, and repair, they all lead to the ultimate overarching goal of the entire sequence.
Which is continuity.
Continuity, the endurance of life across generations, ensuring that our grandchildren can also draw from the same river and rely on the same community.
Okay, I want to list those out again because it's just so foundational. Need, relation, obligation, restraint, sharing, repair, and continuity. In this blueprint, food obviously comes before profit.
Because profit doesn't exist yet.
Right. Care comes before a formal contract. Ecological regeneration comes before extraction. It just makes intuitive sense. If you were marooned on a desert island with 20 other people, this is exactly how you would organize yourselves.
That's how you'd run a functional family, too.
Exactly. But then, as societies grew more complex, we introduced a completely different sequence, a sequence the paper calls money-value sequencing.
And here is where the massive divergence in human history begins, because money value sequencing follows a radically different pattern. It does not start with biological need.
What does it start with?
It starts with price. It establishes a numerical value for a thing or an action.
Okay, so everything gets a price tag. Then what happens next?
Well, once you have a price, you move to the second step, which is contract. You formalize an agreement based on that exchange value. The contract then leads directly to a property claim.
So, defining exclusive rights, this is mine and not yours, based on the contract we just signed.
Exactly. But a piece of paper saying this is mine is totally useless unless you can actually back it up.
Right. Which brings us to the next step.
Enforcement. Because there are exclusive claims, you need an apparatus to impose compliance. You need police. You need courts. You need state power to back up the property claim.
You need the threat of force.
Yes. And that enforcement secures the next step, which is accumulation.
Yeah.
Because your property is secure, you can gather more wealth, more property, more claims than you could ever physically use in a lifetime.
And notice you aren't sharing it, because this sequence doesn't have sharing built into it anywhere. You are just accumulating it.
Accumulation then leads to reinvestment. You put that wealth back into the system to generate even more wealth. And ultimately, the final goal of this entire sequence, the equivalent of continuity in the first sequence, is growth.
Endless expansion?
Endless expansion as the absolute unquestioned measure of success.
Wow. Okay, so need, relation, obligation, restraint, sharing, repair, and continuity versus price, contract, property claim, enforcement, accumulation, reinvestment, and growth. It is a total translation of reality.
It's an alternate universe.
It really is. In this new sequence, living relations get digitized in a way. They get translated into numbers. Like a magnificent, ancient, living, breathing forest just becomes categorized as timber reserves.
Right.
A person's life, their sweat, their time away from their children, it all becomes categorized simply as labor power or human resources. A living river becomes an industrial input.
That translation process is the beating heart of Dr. Saley's paper. It leads to what he calls the Great Inversion.
The Great Inversion.
Yes. The Great Inversion occurs when money value claims become legally superior to the living conditions they originally abstracted. It is the moment in a civilization when the sequence of money literally outranks the sequence of life.
You can see this inversion everywhere once you put these glasses on. Like, the paper points out that under our current legal systems, an eviction is often far easier to enforce than the human right to housing.
Oh, absolutely.
If a bank holds a property claim and wants to enforce an eviction, the sheriff shows up the very next day. But if a family asserts a biological need for shelter, the legal system suddenly becomes very slow, very complicated, and very reluctant to help.
Because the property claim outranks the biological need.
Exactly. Debt collection is protected more strongly and swiftly by the courts than public health is.
And if we trace this to its logical conclusion, it means our legal system has drifted out of its proper nesting.
What do you mean by nesting?
A healthy system nests the symbolic claims, the contract, the title, the debt within the boundaries of living relations. The symbol serves the life. But post-inversion, the system protects the symbol more fiercely than the reality.
Oh, I see.
Corporate return on investment is legally shielded more strongly than the ecological integrity of the town where the corporation operates. Procedural compliance is prioritized over actual physical repair of a harm.
Okay, let's unpack this. I have an analogy forming in my head. It's like building a house. When you build a house, the most important thing is the foundation. The foundation is human life. The soil, the water, the people, the community. To build the house, you draw up a blueprint. And the blueprint represents the money, the contracts, the legal system. It's a drawing.
Right, a representation.
Exactly. It's supposed to guide the construction. But after the Great Inversion, the architects become so obsessed with the blueprint that it becomes more important than the physical house. The foundation starts cracking, the roof is leaking, the people inside are literally freezing. But the architects say, well, we can't fix the roof, because that would require erasing a line on the blueprint, and the blueprint is sacred.
Yes.
They start dictating that we should tear up the living foundation just to make the drawing look better on paper. We are actively destroying the actual house to serve the architectural sketch.
That captures the absurdity of it perfectly. The representation has conquered the reality. But, you know, it is crucial to pause right here because Dr. Sanhili is very deliberate in clarifying something that often gets lost in these kinds of discussions.
Right.
The Great Inversion was not some grand mustache-twirling conspiracy engineered by a secret cabal of evil people.
I am so glad you brought that up.
Right.
The paper makes a massive point of emphasizing that we should not approach this as a blame-first accusation.
No, not at all.
Because if we just point fingers and say, you did this, you're evil, people get defensive and the learning completely stops.
We really have to view this functionally. Money and legal abstractions were not invented to torture people. They actually solved real immense coordination problems for early complex societies.
How so?
Think about the transition from a face-to-face village to a sprawling empire. In a small village, you have direct trust. I know you, I know your family, I trust you to pay me back for the grain I lent you.
Because I see you every day.
Exactly. But how do you organize long-distance trade across oceans? How do you provision a massive army? How do you organize taxation or store agricultural surplus for a multi-year famine across millions of people?
Yeah, you can't rely on face-to-face trust anymore. You can't just shake hands. You need a proxy for trust.
You need a technology of coordination. Money, written contracts, and standardized property claims allowed total strangers to cooperate without direct relationship. It allowed complex obligations to be mathematically calculable.
Right.
In its origin, it was a brilliantly useful tool that likely saved thousands, if not millions, from starvation. The tragedy is simply that the tool accidentally became the master. The abstraction escaped its life ground and just took on a life of its own.
Okay, so if it wasn't a deliberate conspiracy, how did it actually happen? Like, how do laws change and lock in these money-focused values over hundreds or even thousands of years?
Yeah.
If nobody is actively plotting this in a smoky back room, how does the system drift so far off course?
Well, to understand the how, the source material takes a very unexpected turn. It dives into the biology of cognition.
Yeah, and specifically focusing on the work of a Chilean biologist named Humberto Maturana.
Yes. Maturana's concept of legal drift is the engine of this entire theory. Now, I know jumping from property law to the biology of cognition sounds like a massive leap, but stick with the logic here.
Yeah, please help me out here, because I was genuinely scratching my head at this part in the paper. When I think of biology, I think of cells, DNA, mitochondria. I don't think of legal contracts or courtrooms. What does biology have to do with how a judge rules on a contract dispute?
It comes down to how living organisms interact with their environment. In biology, cognition isn't just thinking in the way a human solves a math problem.
Okay.
Cognition is the history of structural coupling between an organism and its environment. For a bacterium, the environment is chemical gradients. But for human beings, our primary environment, the ocean we basically swim in, is language.
We live in a world of words and meanings.
Yes. And Maturana argues that law is not some magical force hovering above us in the clouds. Law is essentially a domain of what he calls recurrent coordinations of action and language.
Recurrent coordinations of action, meaning we just keep doing and saying the same things over and over again together.
Think about it as making distinctions. The law is just a machine that makes distinctions in language. The law says this person is an owner and this person is a trespasser.
Right.
It says this person is a citizen and this person is an alien. It points to a forest and says, this is a natural resource, and points to a corporation and says, this is a legal person.
So the law creates these buckets, these categories, entirely out of language.
And here's the biological aspect. By repeating these distinctions over generations, teaching them in law schools, writing them into property registries, enforcing them in courtrooms, building huge bureaucracies around them, they become self-reproducing.
They become the environment we adapt to.
Exactly. After a few generations, we completely forget that humans invented these categories. We start to experience these linguistic distinctions as natural laws of the universe, like gravity.
That is just wild to think about. A linguistic distinction that was invented to solve a specific political problem for a king in the 16th century gets written down, repeated, and enforced until a judge in the 21st century just accepts it as the natural, unquestionable fabric of reality.
Yes.
The judge isn't being malicious. The judge is just operating within the environment of language they inherited.
And that is the mechanics of legal drift. The legal system continues to conserve and enforce these older distinctions, even when the actual life conditions that made them useful in the first place have completely changed.
Look at appendix.
Like an evolutionary trait that used to be helpful but is now a hindrance. And the paper outlines several specific legal mechanisms of abstraction that really drove this drift. The first one is classification.
Classification. Sorting reality into governable buckets. Because if a state cannot classify something, it cannot tax it, it cannot manage it, or govern it.
But the act of classification is never neutral. It reveals some things while completely concealing others.
Give me an example of that.
Think about the concept of crown land or public domain in colonial history.
Okay.
When a colonial power arrived in a new territory, they looked at a deeply complex living landscape that indigenous peoples had managed and related to for millennia. But the colonial legal system just couldn't process those complex relations. There wasn't a bucket for it.
So what did they do?
So they classified the land as terra nullius nobis land or crown land. By simply applying that linguistic classification, all the prior living, ecological, and spiritual relations to that land were legally erased. They literally became invisible to the court.
Wow. The reality on the ground didn't change, but the map changed, and the map became more important than the territory.
Precisely.
The second mechanism of abstraction the paper brings up is measurement. Law translates life into quantifiable metrics.
Measurement is how the law makes things comparable. Land becomes acreage, time becomes hourly productivity, a profound physical injury becomes a schedule of monetary damages.
Right. You lose an arm in a factory, the law says that arm is worth exactly $50,000. It's a math equation.
Measurement allows for massive, complex administration. You can run an entire empire with spreadsheets. But the fatal flaw of measurement is this: what happens to the things that cannot be easily measured?
They become legally weaker.
Right.
They just vanish from the equation. I mean, you cannot put a neat metric on the grief of a community losing its ancestral home.
No.
You can't quantify the spiritual meaning of a mountain. You can't put a dollar value on the trust between neighbors. So the measurable things like timber yields, quarterly profits, or hourly wages will always mathematically outcompete the unmeasurable things in the eyes of the law.
Which brings us to the third mechanism, which is perhaps the most dangerous of all. Alienability.
The ability to alienate something.
Yeah.
Meaning the ability to strip a relation from its context and transfer it to someone else. This is basically the foundation of all trade, right? You can sell a piece of land or you can assign a debt to someone else.
It is the absolute foundation of global trade. But let's play out the danger of alienability with a concrete scenario. Let's look at debt.
Okay, let's build a hypothetical. Say I am a farmer in the American Midwest in the 1980s. I have a tough year, the crops fail, and I need a loan to keep the farm running.
Okay.
I go down to the local community bank. The banker knows me. He knows my kids. He knows that the soil is usually good and that this drought is just a freak anomaly. We have a living relation. He gives me the loan.
Right. And in a life coherent system, that obligation is nested in a relationship.
Meaning,
if you have another bad year, you go back to the banker. And because he is part of your community, he might restructure the loan. He doesn't want to foreclose on your farm because it harms the town he also lives in. The obligation is restrained by shared continuity.
But because debt is legally alienable.
Exactly. That local bank can bundle your loan with 1,000 others and sell it.
So my debt gets sold to some massive financial institution in New York.
And then that institution bundles it into a derivative and sells it to a sovereign wealth fund in another hemisphere. Your obligation has been completely severed from its context.
It's totally abstracted.
Yes. The creditor holding your debt now has absolutely no relationship to you, no knowledge of the local drought, and no shared interest in your town's survival. To them, your debt is just a micro fraction of a percentage point on a digital ledger.
So when the payment is late, an algorithm automatically triggers a foreclosure. There is no conversation. There is no relation. The alienability allowed the money value to travel thousands of miles away, leaving the life consequences entirely behind.
That is the terror of alienability. It creates power without proximity, and that ties directly into the fourth major mechanism, corporate personality and limited liability.
This one is huge. The law decided at a certain point in history to classify the corporation as a legal person.
Corporate law is an astonishing technology. It really is. It enables massive coordination and innovation because it pools capital, but its core feature is the separation of gain from the responsibility of risk.
That is what limited liability literally means.
Right. The shareholders can reap the endless benefits of accumulation, but if the corporation takes risks that destroy a local environment, exhaust a labor force, or displace a community, the shareholders' personal assets are protected.
The corporation becomes a legal person when it wants to assert property claims or sign contracts, but it does not have the inherent vulnerabilities, the conscience, or the biological life responsibilities of a natural person. It's basically an immortal entity programmed only for growth.
That's a terrifying but accurate way to put it.
But wait, I have to play devil's advocate here. I want to push back on this a little bit. Because as critical as we are being about these mechanisms, classification, measurement, alienability, limited liability, aren't these abstractions entirely necessary?
How do you mean?
If we don't have property titles, if we don't have enforceable contracts, wouldn't modern society just collapse into total chaos? I mean, we can't sustain a global population of 8 billion people by going back to bartering chickens for firewood in face-to-face villages. We need the spreadsheet, don't we?
Yeah, you're hitting on the fundamental paradox, and Dr. Safely is incredibly careful not to fall into romantic utopianism here. He states very clearly, the goal of life-coherent jurisprudence is not to destroy property.
Okay.
It is not to abolish contracts or eliminate money or dissolve all corporations. As you said, they are incredible tools that allow humans to scale coordination.
So if we aren't throwing the tools away, what is the solution?
The goal is to re-nest them.
Re-nest them. Put the tools back in the toolbox and make sure the toolbox is sitting on a solid foundation.
Exactly. We must subject all of these legal mechanisms to an ultimate overarching test. Do they serve life capacity?
That's the test.
Yes. Property is a wonderful stabilizing tool when it serves dwelling, community stewardship, and secure livelihood. But property becomes lifeblind and frankly pathological when it protects endless hoarding, monopoly, rent-seeking, and ecological destruction.
And it's the same with contracts, right? A contract is essential for clarifying mutual obligation between equals. But a contract becomes pathological when it is used to enforce formal consent under conditions of extreme dependency or desperation.
Like what?
Like a gig worker forced to sign away their rights just to feed their family. The signature is physically there on the paper, but the life balance is entirely absent.
That's spot on. We don't throw out the legal tools. We demand that the tools answer to the foundation of life.
So we tend to think of these legal mechanisms, the contracts, the property registries, the measurements, as cold, rational, and emotionless. We imagine the law as a machine of pure logic. But the source material drops an absolute bombshell here. It argues that law is entirely grounded in human emotion.
This is one of the most profound insights drawn from the biology of cognition. We in the West love to separate reason from emotion. We elevate reason and diminish emotion.
Right. Facts don't care about your feelings.
Exactly. But Maturana points out that every rational domain, including the law, including science, rests upon an emotional ground.
Meaning, we don't reason in a vacuum. We reason from within an emotional orientation.
Emotion dictates our initial premise. It dictates what we fear, what we believe is possible, what we feel absolutely must be protected, and who we consider legitimate or illegitimate. The logic simply builds the structure on top of that emotional foundation.
Okay, so if you have a legal system that loudly proclaims it is pursuing justice, but the underlying unspoken emotional ground of the lawmakers is, say, fear, that system will produce a completely different kind of justice than a system grounded in trust.
A profoundly different kind of justice. The paper identifies several pathological emotions that operate as the hidden drivers of legal drift. The first one is fear.
Fear.
When fear is the baseline emotion, it legalizes control.
Let's make that concrete. Criminalizing homelessness.
Perfect example.
If the emotional ground of a city council is the fear of public disorder, the fear of seeing poverty, the fear of property values dropping, that fear will logically produce laws that essentially punish people for not having a place to sleep. The law responds with hostile architecture, with sweeps, with fines. Because fear views the unhoused person not as a human in need of relation, but as a symptom of disorder that must be controlled or expelled.
The logic of the ordinance is totally sound, but the emotional premise is fear.
Right.
The second pathological emotion is scarcity. Scarcity as an emotional ground legalizes hoarding.
Even when there's plenty to go around, scarcity is a mindset.
Exactly the point. It treats life as a brutal, zero-sum competition for limited goods. It makes property rights absolute to the point of excluding others from basic survival.
Wow.
When scarcity is the emotional ground, welfare or social support is viewed with deep suspicion. It is framed as a moral hazard. The logic says, if we give them food, they won't work and there won't be enough for the rest of us.
The third emotion the paper highlights is superiority. The paper argues superiority legalizes hierarchy. You see this vividly manifesting in colonial laws.
Yes, you do.
The colonizers didn't just show up and say, we are evil and we want your stuff. They operated from a deeply held emotional ground of superiority. The legal framework they built categorized colonized peoples as subjects who were legally incompetent, who needed civilizing, who needed a paternalistic administrator.
And you see it in patriarchal laws that naturalize the dependency of women for centuries, too. The emotion of superiority makes domination appear not as violence, but as benevolent administration. It justifies stripping away agency because the law assumes the superior party knows best.
Then we have vengeance. Vengeance legalizes punishment over repair. It builds our massive carceral systems.
When vengeance is the emotional ground of a justice system, the primary question the court asks is, how much pain should be imposed to balance the scales?
Instead of asking the life-coherent question, which would be, what must be transformed in this community and in this offender so this harm does not recur? Vengeance seeks to permanently mark the offender. It leads to social abandonment, solitary confinement, and lifelong felony records rather than rehabilitation. The feeling of vengeance requires the suffering of the other.
And finally, there is perhaps the most modern and insidious emotional state, abstraction, which produces indifference. This one is chilling.
Abstraction as an emotion. That's a wild thought.
It is the emotion of not feeling anything at all for the consequences of your actions. It allows a regulator or a corporate executive to authorize massive harm from a distance because they do not have to literally feel the life world they're destroying.
I picture a guy in a tailored suit on the 40th floor of a high-rise in a major metropolis. He is looking at a spreadsheet. The numbers say that dumping chemical runoff into a river in a poor zip code will save the company $4 million a quarter, and the potential fine from the EPA is only $1 million.
So it's just a business expense?
So he signs the paper. He is completely indifferent. He will never smell the water. He will never meet the children developing asthma. He will never see the dead fish.
Indifference is the toxic combination of distance, abstraction, and procedure. When those three elements combine, massive structural harm can occur without a single person involved feeling any malicious intent. They are just following the procedure.
Here is an analogy that I think crystallizes this whole emotional architecture concept. We have this classic ancient image of the law. It's the blindfolded woman, Lady Justice, holding a perfectly balanced scale. Justice is blind, right? It's purely objective.
That's the myth.
But really, what this paper is arguing is that the scale itself is rigged by the emotional baggage of the people who forged the metal in the first place. Think about a computer program. It's like code written by a terrified programmer. The code executes perfectly. There are no bugs. But the terror is baked into the very architecture of the software. The program will constantly scan for threats, assume everyone is an enemy, and lock down systems preemptively, because that's what the programmer was feeling when they typed the keystrokes.
That is a brilliant conceptualization. The institution itself conserves the emotion of its creators. A welfare office can conserve suspicion. A criminal court can conserve vengeance. A border agency can conserve exclusion. Long after the original lawmakers are dead, the bureaucracy keeps feeling their feelings.
I want the listener to really internalize this. Think about your own interactions with the government. Think about the last time you went to the DMV or applied for a building permit, or more importantly, if you've ever had to apply for unemployment benefits or food assistance. Did you notice the suspicion literally baked into the forms?
The endless verifications, the repetitive questions designed to catch a discrepancy.
The implicit, suffocating assumption that you are probably trying to cheat the system. You are made to constantly prove your legitimacy, your poverty, your innocence, your need. You leave feeling exhausted and humiliated.
Yeah.
That is not just bad customer service. That is the emotion of suspicion translated into administrative law.
And that emotional toll, the humiliation, the exhaustion you just described, that is a feature of the legal drift, not a bug. It trains institutions not to trust the people they are meant to serve.
So how do we fix it?
Dr. Sarli argues that institutional reform has to be emotional reform as well as procedural reform. We have to fundamentally ask, what would this welfare institution look like? How would the forms be written if it conserved a default state of trust and shared continuity instead of scarcity and suspicion?
So we've talked about the mechanics, the classifications and measurements. We've explored the hidden emotions. Let's look at how these emotional grounds actually shaped human history on a macro level. Mm. And I want to set a very firm boundary here before we dive into history. Mm. We are looking at these historical systems not to assign personal guilt to people living today, but to see how normal, legally sound frameworks can carry horrific life harms.
This is where Dr. Salili introduces a crucial ethic for life-coherent jurisprudence. It's a principle that states, every person remains a legitimate other.
Every person remains a legitimate other.
Yes. Naming historical harm is about diagnosing a pattern of coordination. It is not about humiliating the inheritors of that system. We must separate personal blame from relational responsibility.
The paper is incredibly clear on this. If you inherit a broken system, you aren't necessarily guilty of creating it. I wasn't alive 200 years ago. But once you see the harm the system continues to cause today, you become responsible for helping to repair it. Guilt looks backward and demands punishment. Responsibility looks forward and demands coordination.
Exactly.
Let's dive deep into some of these historical drift pathologies to see how this works. The first and perhaps most glaring example is slave codes.
Slave codes represent the absolute horrifying zenith of legal abstraction. It is the ultimate legal conversion of a living person into a piece of property. The legal world conserved a distinction in language where a human being with needs, relations, and cognitive capacity was categorized simply as an object of ownership, subject to inheritance, collateralization, and sale.
And what was the emotional ground there?
The emotional ground was a grotesque superiority fused seamlessly with the desire for economic extraction. The tragedy of the legal drift here is that the law was designed to see the violation of a property right far more readily than it could see the violation of human personhood.
Then there is colonial law. We touched on this earlier with the concept of crown land. The legal distinction here was converting military conquest into legitimate administrative jurisdiction.
The emotional ground was again superiority, but this time joined to total control. Under colonial law, vibrant, living, complex worlds were transformed into governable, simplified objects.
Right.
A living landscape managed by indigenous relations became a resource frontier waiting to be logged or mined. A sovereign community became a subject population to be taxed.
The law was programmed to see its own sovereignty and its administrative order. It was legally blind to the prior living relations of the colonized peoples. It simply couldn't compute them. Now, what about something that feels much more modern and, frankly, something we usually think of as a good thing? Environmental permitting. How can environmental protection be a drift pathology?
It becomes a pathology when ecological destruction is transformed through the legal system into technical compliance. The emotional ground here is our old friend abstraction, joined to a blind religious faith in continuous development.
So instead of asking, should we poison this river, the law asks, how many parts per million of poison is acceptable before we issue a fine?
Exactly the problem. Ecosystems are treated merely as manageable impacts or sinks for industrial waste. If a massive corporation files the right paperwork, conducts the environmental impact study, and keeps its toxic emissions just below the legal threshold, the destruction of the ecosystem is perfectly legal.
It's technically compliant.
It is technically compliant. The law sees the permit and the spreadsheet far more clearly than it sees the living system dying.
The fourth historical example the paper highlights is debt regimes. This goes back to our farmer analogy, but scaled up to the level of entire nations. This is where the future is used as collateral for past monetary claims.
When debt repayment is framed by the legal system as a moral, absolute, and unbreakable obligation, it can force entire countries into crippling austerity. A developing nation might be forced by international financial institutions to cut funding for public health clinics, cut education budgets, and halt climate adaptation projects, all just to service the interest on a debt owed to distant creditors.
The emotional ground is obligation twisted into moralized discipline. The international law sees the repayment of the ledger more clearly than it sees the hunger in the streets or the hollowed-out hospitals resulting from the austerity measures.
Yes.
Now, here's a massive, incredibly important takeaway from the text. This might be the most crucial point for understanding our modern political landscape. Repeal is not repair.
It is a very common, comforting fallacy to believe that once an unjust law is struck down, the harm is undone. But just because a law is repealed, like the official end of apartheid in South Africa, or the end of redlining and segregation in the United States, or the abolition of slavery, it does not mean the physical, spatial, and economic worlds that the law built are magically dismantled.
The afterlives of legal drift continue to haunt us. Let's use redlining as an example.
Okay.
For decades, the law allowed banks and governments to literally draw red lines on maps, denying mortgages and investment to Black and minority neighborhoods. The law enforced segregation.
Mm.
Eventually, the Fair Housing Act comes along and repeals that legal mechanism.
Bruh.
The law is crossed off the books.
But crossing the law off the books does not instantly integrate the neighborhoods.
Right.
It doesn't instantly equalize the school funding, which is based on local property taxes. It doesn't erase the multi-generational racial wealth gap caused by decades of denied home ownership. The highway that was built straight through the middle of the minority neighborhood to serve the wealthy suburbs is still physically there.
The architecture built by the bad law remains standing long after the law itself is gone.
Exactly.
So bringing this back to the listener, what does this mean for us today?
Yeah.
Let's present a scenario. Let's say I buy a house today. I go to the bank. I get a mortgage. I get a valid legal title. Everything is above board.
Sure.
But if I trace the history of that specific plot of land back 150 years,
right,
it is deeply rooted in colonial dispossession or broken treaties with indigenous peoples. How do I, as an ordinary person, approach repair in a situation like that without falling into a cycle of defensiveness or just paralyzing guilt?
This is exactly why Dr. Saheli's distinction between personal guilt and relational responsibility is so incredibly vital for our future. You, the current homeowner, are not personally guilty of the colonial dispossession from 1850. You did not commit the act.
Right.
Therefore, the instinct to feel personal blame and the resulting defensive posturing saying, I didn't do it, leave me alone, is misplaced.
So I don't need to hate myself. I don't need to walk around carrying the guilt of centuries past.
No, you do not. However, you are relationally responsible for recognizing that you currently live within and benefit from a system that continues to legally validate that original unhealed wound.
I am not guilty of the past, but I am participating in the reality of the present.
Responsibility after recognition is the necessary next step in legal learning. What does repair look like?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily mean you forfeit your house and become homeless.
I wouldn't help anyone.
Right. It might mean supporting community land trusts. It might mean participating actively in truth and reconciliation processes. It might mean advocating for legal pluralism. or voting for public policies that materially address the systemic landlessness of the dispossessed communities.
Recoordinating the field.
The goal is to recoordinate the legal field so that the living relation to the land can arise as legally real without just creating new, different disposable populations.
Okay, if we are going to fix these deeply ingrained legal structures without starting a blame war, we need diagnostic tools. We need a way to see the matrix of harm that surrounds us. The paper utilizes two heavy hitters in academic theory to help us do this, Johann Galtung and John McMurtry. Let's start with Johann Galtung's triangle of violence. I love this concept.
Johann Galtung is a foundational thinker in peace studies, and he helps us see that violence is not just an event, it can be an arrangement.
Arrangement.
He breaks violence down into a triangle with three distinct types. At the top of the triangle is direct violence.
Direct violence is easy to spot. This is the visible punch. It's an assault, it's police brutality, it's a physical war. There is a clear actor throwing the punch, there's an action, and there's a clear victim bleeding. The law is very, very comfortable dealing with direct violence.
But the second type, forming one of the base corners of the triangle, is structural violence.
Structural violence.
This is harm that is built into the arrangements themselves. It is laws, policies, and economic systems that predictably and reliably produce life reduction.
Let's build out a structural violence scenario. Imagine an industrial town. Let's call it Riverbend.
Okay.
In Riverbend, the zoning laws, which are totally legal, dictate that heavy chemical manufacturing can only happen on the east side of town. The east side of town also happens to be where the poorest residents live because historically, that's where the cheapest housing was. Over 20 years, the childhood asthma rates on the east side skyrocket to triple the national average. The life expectancy drops by 10 years compared to the wealthy west side of town.
In that scenario, there is no single person throwing a punch. There is no individual villain sneaking into children's bedrooms and making them cough. But the life reduction, the violence against their bodies, is just as real as a punch to the face.
Yes.
And it is mathematically predictable based on the system's design. That is structural violence.
And the third type, completing the triangle, is cultural violence. These are the narratives, the myths, and the meaning systems that make the direct and structural violence seem acceptable, inevitable, or even necessary.
Cultural violence is what anesthetizes society to the harm. In your Riverbend example, cultural violence would be the narrative propagated on the evening news or by local politicians that says property values on the east side are low because the residents just don't care about their community, completely ignoring the toxic zoning.
Or the narrative that industrial pollution is just the necessary cost of economic progress and those people should be grateful they have factory jobs. Cultural violence legitimates the farm so that the broader system doesn't have to feel scandalized by it. It makes the unacceptable seem normal.
And this leads to a profound, unsettling realization from the text. Violence can be perfectly legal.
Wow.
In fact, law is very often the primary carrier of structural violence. A society may not have a law explicitly commanding poor children to become sick, but if its housing, labor, and healthcare policies make that sickness entirely predictable and unavoidable, that society is enacting lawful structural violence.
This triangle concept is incredible. Let me try another analogy. It's like a doctor diagnosing a patient who comes in with a broken arm.
Right.
Direct violence is the broken arm itself, the acute injury. Structural violence is the deep systemic poverty that caused the malnutrition, which made the patient's bones brittle in the first place.
Yes.
And cultural violence is the societal belief that some people, maybe because of their class or background, just don't deserve access to calcium and vitamins. If the doctor just puts a cast on the arm, treating only the direct violence and sends the patient back out, the patient is not cured. The bone will just break again next month because the doctor ignored the structure and the culture.
That is an exceptionally clear way to visualize it. True repair has to be triangular. If you only address the direct punch, if you only arrest the single bad cop or find the single bad CEO, but leave the laws and narratives intact, the structural and cultural violence will just generate new harms tomorrow.
So true.
This brings us to the second thinker, John McMurtry, who provides the ultimate value standard for our diagnosis. McMurtry distinguishes between two opposing forces, life value and money value.
What is the core test for any law under McMurtry's framework?
The test is simple but rigorously demanding. Does this legal arrangement enable life capacity or does it disable it?
Life capacity.
Life capacity is the physical and mental ability to think, to feel, to relate, to breathe clean air, to have safe shelter, and to participate in a community. Life value refers to absolutely everything that enables that capacity. A community garden has high life value. A functional healthcare system has high life value.
The money value is when exchange value, expressed in dollars or euros or yen, becomes the master goal.
Exactly the contrast. McMurtry shows how money value operates as a false universal equivalent. We try to put a price on everything to make everything tradable, but you simply cannot put a price tag on a lost indigenous language.
You can't.
You cannot price a destroyed coral reef. You cannot quantify the developmental deprivation of a child who grows up in a food desert.
Money value can increase infinitely. GDP can go up, the stock market can hit record highs, corporate profits can soar, while actual life value is actively being destroyed on the ground. Life-coherent jurisprudence demands that money value must always remain nested within and subordinate to life value. Money is the tool. Life is the master.
That is the essence of it.
So when the legal system commits this structural violence, when money value overrides life value, where exactly does the impact land? It doesn't just hit our bank accounts. The paper goes into incredible, somber detail about the anatomy of harm across all levels of human existence. It's a cascading effect.
Legal harm is not just a juridical concept contained in a courtroom. It reverberates through the entire biological and social organization of life. The paper identifies five specific levels where this harm manifests. The first is bodily harm.
This is the most visceral. A legal arrangement like an exploitative gig economy labor law or that environmental permitting system we discussed shows up directly in the body. It manifests as chronic exhaustion, toxic chemical exposure, stress-induced cardiovascular disease, or premature death. The law literally writes itself onto our biology.
The second level is emotional harm. We touched on this with the welfare bureaucracies. A system grounded in suspicion or vengeance produces chronic humiliation. It generates deep institutional distrust, pervasive fear, and profound psychological trauma.
And the courts don't even see it.
The tragedy is that the law often struggles to even acknowledge emotional harm unless it can be neatly translated into a diagnosed psychiatric injury by a highly paid expert witness for a tort lawsuit.
The third level is cognitive harm. I found this one fascinating.
Cognitive harm involves the erasure of histories, the narrowing of imaginations, and the suppression of truth. If a colonized people are taught for generations by the state educational system that their ancestral laws weren't real laws and their history wasn't real history, that is a profound cognitive harm. It damages the capacity to understand oneself.
The fourth level the paper details is harm to family and care. Our current legal and economic systems constantly exploit unpaid care work, which is overwhelmingly feminized. Or think about draconian migration laws or aggressive carceral policies that physically rip parents away from children.
Tearing families apart.
Exactly. Yeah. The law treats a deportation or a prison sentence as a simple administrative outcome, but it actively destroys the core unit of human life support, the family.
And finally, we must scale up to the fifth level, ecology and future generations. Harm to the life ground itself. The people who are not yet born, who will inherit a world bound by today's crushing national debt obligations and suffocating climate emissions.
They don't have a say.
They have no standing in our current courts. They have no vote in our elections, and they have no voice. Yet our legal structure transfers immense existential risk to them every single day.
Let me jump in with a massive logistical question here.
Yeah.
If structural harm is this expansive and this interconnected, if a single legal eviction causes bodily stress, fractures a family, causes emotional humiliation, and places a cognitive load on children who now can't focus in school, how can a traditional court of law ever adequately address it? Aren't our courts designed to only look at one isolated broken rule and one specific individual injury at a time?
You have zeroed in on the exact limitation of our current legal paradigm. A traditional court is structurally designed to only see the narrowest sliver of the harm. It looks for the direct violence.
Right.
It cannot compute the cascading structural violence. This is exactly why Dr. Saley argues that the system cannot just be tweaked. It needs what he calls recoordination.
Recoordination, meaning we have to fundamentally change the pattern of how the law interacts with life. We have to change the language and the distinctions we use.
Repair has to match the scale and the level of the harm. You cannot just offer a one-time $10,000 monetary damages payout for the destruction of a community's cultural identity or the poisoning of a local aquifer. That is trying to fix a life value problem with a money value tool. It's category error.
So what does recoordination actually look like in practice?
Repairing a cultural or systemic harm requires multidimensional action. It requires memory restoration. It requires language revitalization. It requires deep democratic inclusion, allowing the affected communities to rewrite the zoning laws.
Empowering them.
Empowering them, yes. It requires institutional transformation so that the welfare office stops conserving suspicion and starts conserving care. It requires changing the very distinctions the law uses to see the world.
Okay. Let's take a breath and bring this all together.
Yeah.
We have been on quite an intellectual and emotional journey today. We've seen how the original biological blueprint of human survival life sequencing was flipped upside down into money value sequencing, the great inversion.
We've explored how our legal coordination drifted into dangerous abstractions, classification, measurement, alienability fueled by hidden emotional grounds like fear, scarcity, and superiority.
We looked at the historical drift pathologies, from colonial land grabs to modern debt regimes, and realized that structural violence hides in plain sight, legitimized by cultural narratives that tell us this is just the way things are.
But the underlying message of Dr. Savely's white paper is not despair. It is fundamentally, radically hopeful, because Maturana teaches us that law is just a conserved coordination, a pattern of repeated human choices and language. We are not trapped. This isn't gravity. It's just a habit.
And habits can be broken. We can choose to coordinate differently. We can choose to re-nest our legal tools, our contracts, and our property rights back into the service of life capacity. We can choose repair over vengeance and responsibility over guilt.
We can learn from the historical disturbances, recognize the structural harm, and actively reorient our jurisprudence.
As we wrap up, I want to leave you, the listener, with a brand new thought to mull over. Something that builds on everything we've discussed today, but points it straight toward the future.
Think about the explosive rise of artificial intelligence and algorithmic decision-making. Right now, as we speak, human beings are writing the code that will govern the future of our species.
That is a very timely and terrifying application of these concepts. The algorithms are the ultimate coordinators.
If our current legal system already treats abstract corporations as persons and living, breathing ecosystems as disposable resources, how will this deeply ingrained money value sequencing govern the non-human intelligences we are currently creating? Will we have the foresight to code AI with life sequencing, teaching it to prioritize human biological need, community care, and ecological repair above all else?
Or will AI become the ultimate emotionless enforcer of the great inversion? Will it become a machine perfectly executing structural violence at the speed of light, optimizing for endless financial growth while remaining totally mathematically indifferent to human life? The law is just code, and AI is just code. It is entirely up to us to decide what we want to conserve.
A profound and urgent question. The abstractions we've discussed today could become automated, permanently locking in the inversion unless we actively choose to code for life.
Remember where we started this journey. Imagine a world before contracts, a world where life, biology, and community came first. As you go about your week, interacting with bureaucracies, signing digital terms of service, or just looking at the unwritten rules that shape your neighborhood, ask yourself one simple question. Does this rule serve money or does this rule serve life? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.